Hi, this is Austin Hill. Hey, thanks for checking out this podcast from Austin Hill in the Morning. Now you can hear our program live weekday morning, 6 till 8 Central Time. There are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows. They're available online. Our web address, of course, myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Start your day connecting faith to life. It's Austin Hill in the Morning.
Good morning. It's now 6:04 Central Time from the Faith Radio Network. Good morning. I am Austin Hill, and welcome to our program. Welcome to Monday. Hope your day is off to a great start. Glad you're with us as well. I'm honored to be with you weekday morning 6 till 8 as we strive to be informative, challenging, hopeful, and helpful here at the start of your day. Lots to talk about. I hope it's still, you know, but hope we continue the warming trend wherever you're living and listening to us today. Later this morning, we will address some issues that came to light in a very, very highly publicized and much watched, much listened to media interview with the former American Olympic athlete, back when I was a very young child, actually, a guy named Bruce Jenner. Did our country proud in the World Olympics as a track star. And, of course, last Friday night on a, as I said, widely watched television interview, he declared that he's really more a woman than he is a man. As a matter of fact, he said, "I am a woman." He's in the process of becoming transgendered. He also acknowledged that he is a Christian. And so we'll address this issue and try to get to some sound reasoning. I know this poses a lot of challenges for a lot of people when we see somebody like Bruce Jenner, somebody so high profile, engage in what to many of us seem like a very bizarre series of events and lifestyle choices and all the rest. And then at the same time say, well, I'm a Christian and I'm trying to be a follower of Christ. Later this morning, about half an hour from now, we'll be privileged to talk with Dr. Frank Moncher. He is a fellow at the nonprofit group called the Culture of Life Foundation. Dr. Frank Moncher, he'll weigh in on some biblical perspective on this very challenging issue of transgenderism. And how best can the rest of us deal with people who are becoming transgendered or who identify as a gender other than that which they were born with? We'll get to that a little bit later this hour. Our great friend Lisa Marone, she'll join us into the 7 o'clock hour. Lisa Marone, best-selling author and physical therapist, the lady that joins us every couple of weeks or so and reminds us to get healthy for heaven's sake. She'll talk about our mental muscle and exercising our minds and our memories. This should be good. This is a challenge, especially as adults age. Keeping your mind and your memory sharp and intact, that requires some effort, some proactive effort. So Lisa Marone weighs in on that. We'll also check in with our great friend Dr. David Stevens from the Christian Medical and Dental Association. He'll give us some thoughts on things to watch for from the human vantage point with respect to the dilemma of the bird flu or avian flu. We talked a little bit about avian flu last week here on the program and spoke to an expert in ornithology, that is the study of birds, ornithology. Talked to an expert here at the University of Northwestern St. Paul in St. Paul, Minnesota, where our network is headquartered. Talked about what the bird flu means to the bird population and the poultry industries and those kinds of things. What kind of health concerns are there, if any, for human beings, for our family members, for ourselves, kids, grandkids, and all the rest? Dr. David Stevens will weigh in on that a little bit later this morning. So all of this and more just ahead. Also, we have, I guess what started off to be very frustrating and disappointing, and now it seems to be very positive news out of Fargo, North Dakota, with respect to some high school students in that city who are championing the cause of being pro-life, the cause of honoring the sanctity of life in all its varying forms, including life in the womb. Some good news from the pro-life high school student front in Fargo. That comes up a little bit later this morning. So all of this and more just ahead. Now, when we come back, very excited to introduce you to our next guest. He is currently the president of the Moody Bible Institute, their ninth president. They're at the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago. And he is doing, I think, a very forthright job at acknowledging something that I think we all realize, those of us who are Christ followers, Christians, living here in the United States of America at such a time as this. He is acknowledging that increasingly our culture is becoming very, very hostile at a very rapid and perhaps even alarming pace, very hostile to our core convictions and our core faith commitments. Dr. Paul Nyquist has a book out just released from Moody Publishing. It's called Prepare, Living Your Faith in an Increasingly Hostile Culture. We'll talk to him coming up next. It's All Right Here. This is the Austin Hill in the Morning program. Glad you're with us. You're listening to the Faith Radio Network. It's now 9 minutes past the hour. Welcome to Monday. It's 11 minutes past the hour from the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. We're glad you're with us. The culture is shifting under our feet. Have you noticed that? That's an issue we address pretty much every day here on this program. It is unavoidable, and the change, rapid in pace as it may be, is unmistakable. How best do we prepare for a future in the United States of America that looks radically different than the America of our parents' or grandparents' generation? Joining us to talk about it and his new book, Prepare, Living Your Faith in an Increasingly Hostile Culture, our next guest. His name is Dr. Paul Nyquist. He currently serves as the ninth president of the Moody Bible Institute. He joins us on our newsline here on the Faith Radio Network. Dr. Nyquist, thanks very much for being here.
Oh, it's an honor to be with you, Austin. Thanks for having me.
Good to speak to you. You note in your book that you believe Christians are in the crosshairs here in the United States of America. What do you mean by that?
Well, I believe our culture has changed. I think we've actually passed the tipping point, Austin, and that means that the societal values are abandoning our biblical values, biblical marriage, religious freedoms are all disappearing. And that means that what we hold to as believers and the Word of God is increasingly not going to be welcome. And so we're going to be told that our voice is not acceptable here anymore.
There's no way to reverse that as far as you're concerned.
Well, God could choose to change things if he chose his desires. I mentioned in the book that I believe unless God visits this country again with a fresh spiritual revival, I don't see things changing. I think the cultural change cycle shows that we're already past that tipping point. These values are being cemented into our culture through law, and I see the trends accelerating. God can choose to change that, and we do pray that he does through a revival, but unless that happens, I think this is what we're facing.
Do you believe Christians can actually change the nature and essence of the laws that we are governed by?
Well, I believe that the laws and the lawmakers will tend to represent the cultural values of our people. And as the culture continues to, integrate these values into our land, that they're going to seek to represent the values that their placeholders have. So I don't see that the political process being changed unless hearts change. And if hearts change and a spiritual revival, then I think it will happen. But unless that happens, no, I don't see that we're going to be able to change the political process or the laws.
Dr. Paul Nyquist, he is the president of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, Illinois. He is the ninth president of the Moody Bible Institute. We're talking about his new book, Prepare, Living Your Faith in an Increasingly Hostile Culture. What are the words that quickly comes up, a piece of terminology, when we talk about the shifting cultural ground beneath us here in the U.S.? It's the word persecution. How is persecution best defined, do you believe, here in the U.S., and how is it different from persecution, say, in other parts of the world?
That's a great question, Austin, because we do see, I think the extreme end of persecution elsewhere, ISIS decapitating believers around the world, that's happening. But persecution is a spectrum that runs from just, oppression and seeking to silence people all the way to that physical persecution. The ultimate end of persecution is there's pressure placed upon people from society or individuals so that their voice is no longer heard. If they can accomplish that by just, marginalization, taking away jobs or privileges, that will accomplish it. But if not, then they will continue to ramp it up through prosecution and ultimately execution. But it's a whole spectrum. Persecution runs a whole spectrum. I think we're just seeing the beginnings of that in different areas here in America.
Dr. Nyquist, with that in mind, I'm wondering, should Christians be actively engaged in the making of our laws, even as we look towards the what seems to be a shrinking reservoir of religious liberty in America? I mean, should we continue to try to be conscientious citizens of a free society and let our voice be heard, or is it time to just kind of pull back and accept the consequences?
No, I believe that as long as we have a voice, we need to seek to be involved in that, and we need to continue to defend ourselves as long as we would have the law on our side. So I never would argue that we need to abdicate that. I just need to, I would just argue that we need to be realistic in this culture that, generally speaking, we are in the minority. I think that the number of believers, let's just take evangelicals. I think the number of evangelicals, according to many different polls, puts it at between 5 and 6%, which is much smaller than I think maybe we have been led to assume. I think we're about 18 to 20 million in this country. And that's going to continue to decline as the older, more God-fearing generations die off and they're replaced by younger, more secular generations. So I see these trends accelerating.
I'm also aware, you may be familiar with this, maybe not, but there is a call among very vibrant churches in the nations of Australia and New Zealand going on right now to pray for revival in the United States of America. Now, those are very secular societies. They certainly don't have the Judeo-Christian or specifically Christian heritage that we do here in the U.S. They seem to get along okay in their secular society, and they find it within their heart to pray for America. Can there be a vibrant movement of the church, even if the nation's laws aren't necessarily what we'd like them to be, and even if the broader culture continues to be headed on a more secularized path?
Oh, absolutely there can be, Austin. I think the New Testament gives an example of that. I mean, that's the environment in which the early church existed, and it was persecution. That's on almost every page of the New Testament, and yet there was, a group that actually turned that world upside down. It can happen, and we have different things bubbling up in this country. We're hosting here on the National Day of Prayer the One Cry movement that is trying to span across this country, calling out to God in these areas. So I think if we humble ourselves and we deal with our own issues as individuals and our lack of maybe doing the things that we need to do as believers in this country and just admit that to God and confess that, perhaps God in his sovereignty will revisit this land. We should all be praying to that end.
Do you believe God has, in some sense, some fashion or another, I don't know, abandoned or let go of America?
Well, I believe that the Romans 1 sequence is real, that as you see people abandoning the things of God, God gives them over to their own desires, and that's not a good spiral. I think that is real, and God could be doing that. We don't know the purposes of God on this. We do know that when a country seeks righteousness, that God chooses to bless that, and he has in this country. It's been used all around the world to further the gospel. Could those days be coming to an end? I don't know. I hope not, for the sake of my children and my grandchildren, that this country again comes back to God and a fresh wave of the gospel strikes across this earth.
Dr. Paul Nyquist is the president of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago. His book is in part what we're talking about. It's called Prepare, Living Your Faith in an Increasingly Hostile Culture. Just a couple of moments left, Dr. Nyquist. Name one area of our lives, if you would please, that you believe, for most of us anyway, needs to change. You're speaking to change when you tell us to prepare. What do we need to prepare for? In what area of our lives do we need change in order to get along in an increasingly hostile culture?
Well, I believe for most American Christians, it's to realize that we are no longer going to be in a society that has embraced or supported our values. It's going to be antagonistic to our values. And we need to be already thinking, how do we live godly in that kind of society? And that's not something we're used to in this country. And so our tendency will be to try and retaliate, maybe to act in ways that are not particularly godly. And I'm trying to, I go through this book and just lay out the biblical principles here on, you know, God, Jesus says, love your enemies and pray for them. And those are words we tend to just breeze over, but when things are taken away from us, we want to retaliate. I think there's a different attitude that we're to have. So my whole point in this book is to make sure that we understand what's going on in this culture, and there's a way in which God wants us to respond that reflects righteousness.
Well stated, as always. Dr. Paul Nyquist, president of Moody Bible Institute, his book, Prepare, Living Your Faith in an Increasingly Hostile Culture. We've got info on that from our network website, myfaithradio.com. Dr. Nyquist, we appreciate your time. Appreciate the book, and I hope you'll come back and join us. I applaud what you're doing on behalf of Moody Bible Institute and the upcoming National Day of Prayer. I hope we'll be talking again soon.
My pleasure, Austin. Blessings on you.
And to you as well, sir. It's now 21 past the hour from the Faith Radio Network. Good morning. It's Monday. Our program continues momentarily. Don't go anywhere.
My Savior loves me.
Hey, good morning. It's now 24 past the hour. From the Faith Radio Network, I'm Austin Hill. Honored to have you with us. Weekday morning, 6 till 8 Central Time, as we seek to be informative, challenging, hopeful, and helpful here at the start of your day. Should high school students in Fargo, North Dakota, or anywhere else in the United States of America, should Christian high school students in a public school setting, should they be treated equally and have the same equal opportunity to have on-campus clubs as students who perhaps don't profess a Christian faith or in any event want to participate in more secular sorts of club activities? That is the dilemma. That is the question that a lot of students in Fargo and their parents and perhaps even pastors and church leaders in North Dakota are contemplating. As high school students within what is known as the Fargo Public School District Number 1, They're sort of battling it out, I guess, to have high school students there permitted and allowed to actually assemble an on-campus pro-life club. We'll talk more about that later this morning. Some Christians would look at this and say, hey, why bother? What difference does it make? It really doesn't matter. Forget trying to have a on-campus pro-life club at a public high school. It's really kind of a futile sort of thing. I'll tell you more about what's going on there in Fargo. Think about that. We'll talk about it later this morning here on the Austin Hill in the Morning program. It's now 26 past the hour, weekdays at 12 noon Central Time here on the Faith Radio Network. You hear the Connecting Faith broadcast. Last Friday, host Joe Rathmanner welcomed author Megan Clinton to the program as they talked about her book, Be Rebellious, Fight Back Against a Culture That Doesn't Care About You. My goodness, that sounds interesting. Here's part of that discussion.
This idea of contentment of, I just want to make sure I'm doing what God has called me to do. Some people even think that there's a higher calling placed on a life that's engaged in ministry. And I hear that from my students a lot, that they're less than if they're not going into a career that is full-time ministry. And I don't think that's what Jesus is saying at all as he's talking in the Gospels. It's absolutely not what calling is all about, that we are called into so many different vocations. We are called into so many different kinds of lives and places, but that we are to honor and trust him, like you were just saying, that is our true calling. How can we start focusing more on that and less on feeling like we're less than because we're not doing something that maybe our friends are doing?
Yeah, one of my favorite authors and speakers is Beth Moore, and I love listening to her Bible studies in the car because it's something that I feel like I can do when I feel like I'm stressed and I need something from the Lord that day. So she has, in one of her Bible studies, she talks about this, and she says, you know, she said, sometimes people do feel exactly how you describe, like they are less than because they may not be in ministry. But she was laughing about it, and she says, you know, sometimes I feel like God wouldn't trust me to not be in ministry, to be outside of it. Because, you know, sometimes it is a challenge. You come in contact with people from totally different walks of life, and you have to learn how to relate to them and work together and form a team. I know I found that in the medical field, and I feel like it's a great opportunity for you to be involved with people who may not come in contact with someone who knows the Lord at all. Mm-hmm. And actually, it's been a huge blessing for me because I grew up, you know, I went to a Christian high school and then a Christian college. And then when I went to Jefferson, it was like my really, you know, first exposure to being away from home, like my hometown in Lynchburg. But it was great for me because it really made me think about my relationship with God and why I believe the things that I believe, and do I believe that this is going to be true in my life, and am I going to live a life that's pleasing to God and, you know, not fall into the temptations like we had talked about before. And I think that can be a great growth experience for you as a Christian, to be surrounded by people who push you to be honest, and you can be an incredible light for them, and you can invite them to church, and then it's a wonderful experience. And I do not think that God ever wants us to feel less than, because I think that he's placed desires in our hearts. We need people from every field to bring people closer to the Lord.
That was from last Friday's episode of Connecting Faith. Coming up on today's episode, host Neil Stavem talks with business leader and entrepreneur Sebastian Traeger about the biblical model of work and having a job. That's today, 12 noon Central Time from the Faith Radio Network. Good morning. It's now 6:30. I'm Austin Hill. Still to come, we'll address transgenderism, get a Christian perspective on that. SRN News on the way next. Now 35 past the hour from the Faith Radio Network. I am Austin Hill. Great to have you with us. I'm here weekday morning 6 till 8 as we strive to be informative, challenging, hopeful, and helpful here at the start of your day. Coming up after the news at the top of the hour, another update on the bird flu as it sweeps across regions of the upper Midwestern United States and elsewhere around the country. What, if any, are the human health concerns that are entailed in this? Our great friend Dr. David Stevens, MD, from the Christian Medical and Dental Associations, he'll weigh in on this and tell us what we need to know so as to safeguard ourselves, our own health, and that of our families. That and more just ahead here on the Austin Hill in the Morning program. So, what happens when somebody you've known for perhaps quite some time announces to you that they are changing their gender? Well, here in the United States of America especially, and really around the world, we're kind of experiencing this in a very high-profile, if not somewhat impersonal sort of fashion. A guy that I grew up watching on the Olympics, and a man who did our nation proud, Bruce Jenner, back in the day, he declared on national, international television last Friday night,
I am a woman. He said, for all intents and purposes, I'm a woman. People may see me as this macho male, but my heart and my soul and everything that I do in life, it is a part of me. That female side is a part of me. That is who I am. This brings to light a dilemma for a lot of people. How do we square this with our understanding of historic Christian teaching and really our very intuitive understanding of what it is to be a human being? Joining us to talk about this, a gentleman who is a clinical psychologist. He's also a fellow at the nonprofit group called the Culture of Life Foundation. The Culture of Life Foundation is a group that tells us they make complex moral issues seem simple. This is certainly, I think, qualifies as a complex moral issue. Dr. Frank Moncher joins us on the newsline. Dr. Moncher, welcome to the Faith Radio Network. Good to have you with us this morning.
Good morning, Austin. Good to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Where do we begin a discussion about transgenderism and what it means to be born a specific gender but then transferred into another one?
I think one of the things that people need to understand up front is the distinction with this and same-sex attraction. I think some people confuse homosexuality with transgenderism, and this is where the, as you say, the complex moral issues come in, and I'll do my best to try to make it clear. One of the things that I think is a starting point is for the vast majority of people, their sex at birth is very, very clear, and it's not only an external phenomenon. It also has to do with brain chemistry and, of course, genetics. And so this kind of idea that you can switch what your gender is just because of how you feel is really quite misguided.
Nonetheless, people do that, and they change their brain chemistry as well as their outward physiological appearance with hormonal treatment and surgical procedures and those kinds of things. Misguided as it may be, help us understand what's going on here.
Well, there's not clearly one pathway where this is happening. The biggest fear, clinically speaking, is that the age at which people seem to be considering this keeps getting lower and lower. And parents who, I think in years and decades past, would have been very clear if their 4 or 6 or 8-year-old boy, for example, came up to them and said that I feel like a girl or I'm a girl. Parents in the past would confront that and I think seek some appropriate help to kind of help the child understand that they may be having certain feelings, but that they were made a certain way and that they're going to be happiest in life and flourish best if they follow that design that they were born with. There's a lot of propaganda and a lot of activism now about trying to normalize this phenomena. And I think some parents are frankly confused about what they're to say to their young children when this kind of thing comes about.
Dr. Frank Moncher, he's a clinical psychologist. He's with the nonprofit Culture of Life Foundation. He's on our newsline here on the Faith Radio Network. I'm intrigued with your use of the word propaganda. I certainly would agree with that. There is a lot of propagandizing surrounding this issue. And in our culture, it seems to me, Dr. Moncher, that this very emotionally laden message, when somebody steps up and says, I'm a woman trapped in a man's body, this emotionally laden message really tugs on people's heartstrings, and I guess out of a sense of compassion, many want to sort of swoop in and say, well, let's nurture you and affirm you in whoever it is you want to be. Now, is that the response that you're saying is misguided? And if so, why would you say it is misguided?
Right. That's exactly right. Yeah. The reason for I call it misguided is this compassion, although understandable, particularly if it's someone you've loved and you've known for a long time, you want them to feel well. You want them to feel better. The misguidedness comes in from the research that shows that people who experience this phenomena are in quite a bit of distress, and changing their gender identity, saying that they're the opposite sex from which they were born, does not eliminate that distress. And so the real compassionate response is one of, yes, I understand you're in distress and that the life is not going the way you thought it would and that you've got these things that you're troubled by. The solution is not to pretend as if you're something you're not. you know, the solution would be to try to explore and understand why it is you're having these feelings, and then to come up with a way of living as you were made in a way that's more functional. I use the word propaganda because the statistics are pretty readily available that the level of suicide attempts and completed suicides and depression is greatly higher for people who are experiencing transgenderism. And what the propaganda says is, well, that's because society is not accepting enough of them.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the truth is that there's higher incidence of these psychological problems because the transgenderism itself is something that's not in their design, and that they're fighting nature, as it were. And if you fight nature, you're going to have some psychological problems.
What are the consequences for the individual or for a culture? What, individual or collective, what are the consequences when we, quote-unquote, fight nature?
Well, I think there's a lot of confusion. And again, I go back to the youth. I know in schools in my area, there's a lot of initiative about, you know, should we be more accommodating to young children who come out and say that they feel different to us. The most provocative of which is, you know, allowing them to use the opposite gender bathroom from that, which is their biological sex.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've tried to say in my writings is that this is really putting the need, and again, it's a misplaced compassion, the need of one child ahead of an entire school's, the other children in that school who, you know, shouldn't have to be confused by or confront someone from the opposite sex in their bathroom. And again, it's this kind of misguided compassion. They're thinking the people who are lobbying for this are thinking that they're going to be somehow making this young person's life easier, where in fact they're just delaying the inevitable. At some point, this young person will realize that they're not going to actually feel better and flourish and heal by trying to pretend they're something they're not.
I don't know what statistics would tell us about that in terms of research. What does concrete data tell us about a person who, perhaps like apparently Bruce Jenner is preparing for, they undergo hormonal treatments and surgical procedures to become the opposite gendered? Are they generally happy and pleased with their eventual status, or do problems persist?
I think the data would say problems persist. There's typically a short-term spike in what you would call well-being or happiness. The person finally has made a decision and done something about it, and that's just kind of standard psychology. When we make a decision, we do something about it, we feel a little bit more empowered and in control. In the short run, we feel better. What the evidence shows, and there's not a lot of it because it's not all that common a phenomena, is that as years go by, the person's other issues begin to resurface, and they realize that they're still struggling with the same problems they were before. And in the meantime, they've perhaps done something to their body that's irreversible, and there's some grief and some loss about that as well.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Muncher, comment, if you will, on the nature of the human soul in the midst of this. And the reason I say this and ask for this is it strikes me that we're kind of at this, maybe this turning point or this pivotal moment in our culture, wherein for many decades, if not a century or more, modern science, the medical profession, other disciplines have insisted that this ancient idea of the existence of a human soul is just nothing but fabrication. It's just sort of fantasy. We can look inside a person's cranium. We can look inside their body. We see a heart. We see a brain. There is no such thing as a soul, despite what Christian theology and historic biblical teaching says. So the secular idea that the soul is just sort of a fantasy cooked up idea is to be dismissed quite quickly. But at the same time, we have people like Bruce Jenner saying, deep within my soul, I am the opposite gender of what I appear. And the culture swoops in and says, well, you need to follow your soul and pursue that which your soul is telling you to pursue. I mean, are we kind of confused in the culture about what the human soul is and whether it exists or not?
I think very much so. And, yeah, with all due respect to Mr. Jenner, I think he, you know, misused language a lot during that interview. And he was using words fairly loosely in terms of their true meaning. You know, the body is the form of the soul, and so to separate out your body and your soul as if they're sort of separate things, I think what he was really saying was that he feels. He was making an emotionally based decision about how he feels, and you know, he asserted that, of course, he felt this way since he was a young child, and that may be so for him. For many people, though, there's a fluidity to this, and again, this is where the statistics are hard to come by, and it's difficult because, you know, it's not impossible for someone to have felt this way as a youth and to have what we used to say growing out of it as they've developed and matured and obtained a greater sense of who they truly are. This feeling they had when they were a youth goes away. And again, that's the perniciousness of people who are trying to lock children into establishing an identity prematurely and not letting, if you will, nature take its course.
Mm-hmm. All right. Dr. Frank Boncher, he is a clinical psychologist. He is also a fellow at the nonprofit Culture of Life Foundation. Dr. Boncher, if you can stand by for just another couple of moments, I have one following question. We'll continue with Dr. Boncher in just a moment as we try to get some wisdom and better understand this cultural phenomena, as he describes it, that is becoming more and more common, more and more prolific, and poses challenges, at the very least, to the way we view the world around us. It's the phenomena of transgenderism. We'll continue with Dr. Boncher in just moments. 47 past the hour now from the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. Good morning. We're glad you're with us. At 50 minutes past the hour from the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your support of Faith Radio. We appreciate you stepping up and being a part of our support team at myfaithradio.com. Join us anytime at myfaithradio.com. How best to understand this cultural phenomena called transgenderism? Dr. Frank Boncher is a fellow at the nonprofit Culture of Life Foundation. He's on our newsline and joining us this morning. Dr. Boncher, I'm curious to know, what advice would you offer to the Christian, be it that they are clergy or laity, either one, the Christian who is trying to search the scriptures, look to scriptural truth, and find a foundation and find an answer to some of the questions that this cultural phenomena begs of us, recognizing, of course, I mean, as I look at that dilemma, I think, okay, well, the writers of either the Old or New Testament, they never could have imagined a day where there would be such a thing as hormonal gender transformation or surgical gender transformation. What is the thoughtful Bible-based Christian to make of this, and how best do we approach this?
Well, I think we begin with the beginning, Genesis, and, you know, God made them male and female is what it says very clearly, and I think that's where we need to go back to from a faith perspective as the beginning and end of it, that, you know, when you deviate from that, you can't help but be asking for some sort of trouble, and so with based on that truth that God made man male and female, when someone is struggling with this, the compassionate thing to do, the charitable thing to do, is to, of course, be sensitive to the fact that they're in a dilemma. You know, by definition, they're struggling. This is not an easy cross to bear. And so if someone's feeling this way, you know, we do need to meet them with Christian compassion, not with criticism, not with ridicule, not with any kind of harshness. And at the same time, help them to understand that the truth is what's going to set them free, that, you know, knowing that they are made in God's image and likeness and that they are loved by Christ like any other is going to be a part of the healing process for them, and that they can't take control over that just because they feel a different way. They can't wrest control away from God's design and think that they're going to end up flourishing and being happy. They need to somehow come to understand how it is that they're feeling this way, and And for some, like with other sorts of situations, it can be a lifelong cross to bear where they do have to accept some suffering that for reasons we can't know on earth are being presented to them.
Well, when you describe it that way, you make reference to a lifelong cross to bear. I'm reminded of the admonitions from the Apostle Paul when he made reference to the thorn in his flesh, some sort of attachment to sin that haunted him, that he could not let go of, that he could not shake, and yet he at the same time said that God's strength was made perfect in the middle of his weakness. Is there necessarily resolution for the person who senses that somehow they're confused, they're lost, they struggle with their gender identity? We'd like to think in our culture that that can be fixed, that they can live happily ever after, but is that necessarily always the case?
Probably not always the case. You know, one of the things that as a psychologist is lamentable to me is that our professional organizations have really steered clear of this issue and have not developed any of the kinds of therapies and procedures that may be brought to bear that could actually bring people to heal from this. And so it could for some be, like you say, a thorn that is a part of their struggle. One of the things that I always like to be clear about is, you know, the distinction between feelings and behavior. And so feeling as if you're transgendered is not per se sinful itself. You know, our feelings are what they are, and we don't always have control over those. What you decide to do with that feeling, you know, whether you decide to embrace who God made you or whether you decide to try to change who God made you, I think that's where it becomes a different story. And so, you know, again, it would be helpful if our professional organizations would recognize, as they did 20, 30 years ago very clearly, that, you know, there's a lack of order in this sort of way of thinking, people trying to change their gender, and that what the doctors really ought to be doing is helping them come to terms with who they are and not artificially change it in some hope that it's going to lead to a better life.
Dr. Frank Moncher, a fellow at the Culture of Life Foundation. cultureoflife.org is where you find them online. We also will have information about Dr. Moncher and the foundation on our website at myfaithradio.com. Dr. Moncher, thank you for your insight, your thoughtful comments this morning. We look forward to talking again. We appreciate your availability.
Thank you so much, Austin. Glad to be.
Good to be with you. It's 55 past the hour from the Faith Radio Network. Monday morning underway. Glad you're here. Good morning. It's 56 past the hour from the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill, weekday mornings 6 till 8, weekdays 3 till 5 p.m. Central Time. It's the Live the Promise program with Susie Larson. Last Friday on Susie's program, she spoke with Sam Pierce of Steiger International. They discussed God's heart for global youth. Let's listen in.
How do we communicate Jesus to these people who have such a negative view of Jesus? And so at time of prayer, he felt like he should start a band called No Longer Music. And it was a tool that he could go to places like nightclubs and festivals and communicate Jesus to people who had never stepped foot into a church. And so now you flash forward 30 years, wow, and it's become this whole production that involves live music and theatrics and special effects, all designed to communicate the message of Jesus outside the church.
Absolutely amazing. You want to chime in at all?
Yeah, well, it's unbelievable that that's really what I get to do with my life. And and again, I think it speaks to who God is. He's an unbelievable creative God. And I think, again, back to that hope that's in us, I think people have a perspective of Christians that they're rigid and boring and that they don't get to experience anything. And I think the opposite is true. The closer I get to God, the more free I become, the more fully who I'm supposed to be. And I think even, honestly, the show's creativity and passion and energy speaks to the God that we serve, let alone, of course, the fact that we clearly communicate who Jesus is. So it's a huge privilege. This will be my ninth tour with No Longer Music. And I really couldn't imagine doing anything else.
So you have these secular youth that have no really faith context, and you're telling a gospel message in kind of a fire and lights type of story where they actually see, you know, Jesus being crucified, but in a different kind of symbolic way, and then him being risen from the dead. And looking at some of these youth in the audience with their hand over their mouth.
That was from last Friday on the Live the Promise program. Susie Larson returns this afternoon, 3 o'clock.
Start your day connecting faith to life. It's Austin Hill in the Morning.
Good morning. Welcome to Monday. Great to have you with us. 4 minutes past the hour from the Faith Radio Network. I am Austin Hill. Honored to be with you. Weekday morning, 6 till 8 Central, as we strive to be informative, challenging, hopeful, and helpful here at the start of your day. Coming up later this hour, just about an hour from now, we'll talk about high school students and on-campus pro-life clubs. Is it still a worthy thing for teenagers to pursue the presence of pro-life and otherwise Christian organizations, Christian campuses, on public Christian clubs, I should say, on public school campuses? There is a controversy in the state of North Dakota I'll tell you about. We'll get to that in just about an hour from now. Also, later this hour, Breakpoints with John Stone Street. That comes up in just about 20 minutes, so stand by for that. And an update on the crisis that is the nation of Nepal right now, and Christians and Jews, I might add, around the world responding to the devastation, the carnage left behind in that very devastating earthquake that occurred just a few days ago. All of this and more just ahead here on this episode of Austin Hill in the Morning. In the northern Midwestern states, the upper Midwestern states, and elsewhere around the United States of America, there is this problem. I guess we put it in the category of pestilence, but it's more often than not referred to as the bird flu, more technically known as the avian flu. Last week, we spoke to a professor of ornithology, the study of birds, that is, and talked about what the bird flu meant for bird populations and for the poultry industry. But what about human health concerns, if there are any? Joining us to discuss that, our great friend Dr. David Stevens, MD, president of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. He's on our guest line. Dr. Stevens, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Oh, it's always good to be with you, Austin.
Pleasure to be with you. What do we need to know about the bird flu and its possible health concerns for us?
Well, it's not very transmissible to humans. It's not that it can't be, but it's not nearly as what we saw with some of the flus that came out of Asia. And so everybody's telling everybody to be, you know, take precautions, do what you normally do when you're fixing poultry and eggs and other kinds of meat, and that's wash your hands with warm water and soap for at least 20 seconds before and after handling raw poultry and eggs. Keep away contaminating the other foods in your kitchen with those before they're cooked. Wash your cutting board well and sanitize your cutting board and then cook your meat well. But this is not very transmissible at this point to humans, which I think gives us all a good sigh of relief. Now, it's probably going to affect the price of eggs and chicken and everything else because we're talking about millions of turkeys and chickens that have already been euthanized.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think we're already starting to see that, and your point's well taken. I seem to recall Dr. Stevens, I believe it was in the year 2005, 2006, we had, a bit of a bird flu scare back then, and the U.S. federal government launched a website. As best I recall, the URL was birdflupandemic.gov. That was through the Department of Health and Human Services, I believe. I don't think that website is active right now, and that may have been a case of maybe overdoing it just a little bit. But nonetheless, our federal government was anticipating that it could be a real problem, and they wanted to be at the ready. And when I hear the word pandemic, that is a concern to me. Give us an idea of what we might look at, what could be a pandemic, and what that might entail if indeed this got worse.
Well, interestingly enough, we type these viruses, and this is called the H5N1. mm-hmm. which is exactly the way we called the virus that we were concerned about, the pan epidemic in 2005 and 2006. But this H5N1 virus is different. That H is a type of protein, the N's a type of protein, and they type them. What happened was that a bird flu from Asia actually came over into the U.S. and combined with the bird flu that we normally have here, which is low pathogenic bird flu. It doesn't really cause that much problem in birds and nothing in humans, and created a new bird flu. This one's new, something we haven't seen in this country. But fortunately, it's been demonstrated that it's not transmittable to humans. When you get into problem with bird flu is when humans can get it and transmit it to another human being through their secretions, through their coughing, aerosolize it as they sneeze or cough and put it into the air and give it to other people. Mm-hmm. When that happens, then you really get into a difficult situation. And of course, the worst example of that was way back in 1918 when there was a huge flu epidemic in this country that killed mainly younger people, and lots and lots of people died. In fact, if you talk to your grandparents, they knew someone in their community, probably numerous people, that had died of the bird flu back in the 1918 time, right at the end of the war.
Mm. So we have some pretty serious history with it, but not a big concern right now at this juncture.
It's not. But one of the interesting things that just came out today, Austin, is that they've said, well, this is not really aerosolized. It's not really coming through the air between farms for the chickens and turkeys and ducks to get it. Now they're beginning to suspect that may be the case because we're seeing this spread so rapidly from farm to farm despite what they're doing to prevent this getting into their flocks, making sure that they're not bringing equipment in from other barns that could carry the secretions, trying to keep the birds away from wild birds that may be flying by and their excretions and stuff like that. But now they're saying because of the wind and dust and some in certain areas, that this may actually be being passed by farm, by air. And that's one of the reasons that we've seen such huge numbers of birds, over 8 million now, mm-hmm. having to be euthanized because they've come down with this illness.
Yeah. Well, that's, I guess, the good news on some fronts, but a word of caution. We need to wash and remain clean and be cautious with food preparation, and that's good to know. Dr. David Stevens, MD, he's the president of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations, weighing in on the facts, separating that from the fiction and maybe some of the fear and the paranoia over the bird flu here in the United States. Dr. Stevens, as always, we appreciate what you do. Great to talk with you this morning.
Good to be with you, Austin. God bless.
And you as well. Always a pleasure. 10 minutes past the hour from the Faith Radio Network. I am Austin Hill. We're glad you're with us. How best do we keep our memories sharp? Let's talk about little mental exercises, shall we, to keep the memory muscle going. Our great friend Lisa Marone, healthcare practitioner extraordinaire. She weighs in on our memories up next here on Faith Radio.
Getting your day started, connecting faith to life. Back to Austin Hill in the morning.
12 minutes past the hour from the Faith Radio Network. Good morning, I'm Austin Hill. Honored to have you with us. I'm here weekday morning, 6 till 8 Central Time, as we seek to be informative, challenging, hopeful, and helpful. How does one keep their memory sharp? Well, exercising and building up your mental muscle. That's the way to do that, obviously. But how in the world do you exercise your memory and your brain and keep things sharp? Well, for that, we go to our great friend Lisa Marone, physical therapist, professor, and author. She's always here every couple of weeks or so, reminding us to get healthy for heaven's sake. Most recently, she's written about building your mental muscle. Lisa Marone, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. So great to be with you.
Always good to talk to you. Now, for the person who's saying, well, wait a minute, my memory, my brain is a muscle. That doesn't make sense to me. I can flex my muscles. I can see and feel my muscles. I've never thought of my brain or my memory as a muscle. Where are we going here with this?
Well, I like to look at the brain as a muscle because it has function. And, of course, it's not physiologically like a muscle. It doesn't have muscle fibers, but we do flex our muscles every time we use our brain in a more intricate way where we're thinking through problems or we're thinking about what to say next, or we're teaching in a Sunday school class, or wherever God would have us. And it's so very critical as Christians that we realize that not only do we need functioning bodies that are strong to do the work of God, but we need functioning minds. We need to have clarity of thought. We need to have good recall. And so if God is going to use us in a mighty way in our third trimester, we want to make sure our brain is ready for that kind of challenge.
Mm. Now, you make reference to the third trimester. I presume you mean the latter third of one's anticipated lifespan. Why necessarily is the final third of life in need of more memory and muscle workouts than perhaps the other two thirds of our life?
Well, the first third of our life, up to about 30 years old, we're not losing any brain cells. So we're all fresh, and we used to talk to my children and tell them that they had soft, squishy brains. They could remember everything. Mm-hmm. But at about 30 years old, we'll start to lose naturally some brain cells. Our brain cells will begin to die off. And so by the time we get to 60, if we've not done anything to protect that die-off or to reverse that die-off, then we end up with less muscle power in our brain, if you would. So we have broken connections from brain cell to brain cell, or we just have certain brain cells that have checked out. So our brain may be stringing a message along, and then all of a sudden the bridge is out, if you would, and it can't get to the next cell. And so that third trimester is a trimester that not only can our brain have the greatest challenges from age, say, 60 to 90, but I always love that third trimester of life for the Christian, because we've had all of a life's experience. We've seen God's hand move. We have been in God's Word, and we are so rich at that point to feed into the generations that follow. And so that's where I just think is such a powerful point in life.
Mm. That's very well stated. Lisa Marone, she is a licensed physical therapist, best-selling author, and a professor. She's talking about building up our mental muscle. You know, as you're describing this, Lisa, it just strikes me that some people, we can look to people in their, shall we say, the sunset of their years, and recount our own experiences. At least I can, and I suspect you can, and probably most of our listeners can. We can look back at elderly folks that we've known. Some of them remain mentally sharp right unto the end, and others didn't. When we come back, yeah. We need to take a quick break, but I want you to kind of spell out for us, if you would, what makes the difference? What keeps us in good shape? And why is it that some remain mentally sharp and others don't? We'll continue with Lisa Marone in just a moment as we talk about building up one's mental muscle and what exactly are the exercises that enable us to do that. We'll continue with Lisa Marone in a moment. 17 past the hour from the Faith Radio Network, I'm Austin Hill. It's now 19 minutes past the hour from the Faith Radio Network. I am Austin Hill, and I'm glad you're with us. Lisa Marone is a physical therapist, a best-selling author, and a professor. And her latest writing is on the issue of building up our mental muscle with exercise. Lisa, why is it that some people reach the latter years of their lives and they seem just sharp as they ever were, and others simply do not?
Well, you know, there's this saying that says you are what you eat, and part of our mental decline comes from the way that we've been feeding our bodies and our brains throughout life. Heart-healthy foods, we know, are going to make a brain healthy as well. And we've also heard a lot of literature, read a lot of literature about keeping your brain sharp by doing puzzles. But I'm here as a physical therapist to give you some really cool news. That
yes.
You can actually sharpen your brain's mental capacity through physical exercise and activity.
I like that. As a matter of fact, I like that idea better than puzzles. I'm just not a puzzle guy.
I agree with you, Austin. I'm not a big puzzler myself. And so but I do love to move. And so anything from yard work to gym exercise and dance classes, when we produce physical stress in our body, the physical stress of exercise, we've raised our heart rate, we've raised our respiratory rate, our brain produces this beautiful miracle growth substance. It's called brain-derived neurotrophin factor. And what that actually does is it floods through the brain, and it stimulates new brain cell production. And it also takes the connections from brain cell to brain cell and strengthens those. And so it does a beautiful thing for our brains. While we might be sweating on the outsides, our brains are rebuilding on the inside. I love that.
Yeah, I love hearing that. So brain cells absolutely do get renewed, or new ones can be created. It's not just a steady, slow process where we have brain cells die. It actually can be reversed.
It can be reversed. You know, there was this fabulous study that they did. They took 71-year-old sedentary men, and they put them on a daily exercise regime, and then they followed them over 5 or 6 years. And what they found was, when compared to their non-active 71-year-old, aging to 76-year-old men, that they had a 50% decrease in dementia when compared with those who are non-exercising. So if you want to protect your mind beyond puzzling and beyond eating well, those are very important things, but exercise is going to do that for you in a tremendous way. 50% more brain power in just 5 years, that's fabulous.
Yeah, I like that a lot. What sort of foods are good for the brain?
Brain-healthy foods are going to be things that protect the outer membranes of brain cells, and those are omega-3 fatty acid types of foods. Those are our cold water fish, like salmon, herring, sardines. We're going to eat things like walnuts that are going to have a high omega-3 content, flaxseed ground into foods that we eat, stored into things. Those are really important foods, but also anything that has antioxidants in it. We were talking a couple of weeks ago about beans and how they're so high in antioxidants. Those are going to just work against the aging process, those oxygen-stealing free radicals that wreak havoc in our brain. And so anything that you have read that's a heart-healthy food is going to be a brain-healthy food as well.
Good to know. It's Lisa Marone. Her latest writing on this subject is entitled simply Build Up Your Mental Muscle with Exercise. You can find that at our website at myfaithradio.com. Speaking of your last visit here on the program, Lisa, I do recall we had quite an interesting discussion about beans. As a matter of fact, I received several email messages from listeners updating me on issues pertaining to legumes. In fact, one gentleman said, well, what Lisa Marone was saying makes perfect sense. Where have you been, Austin? Why was this news to you? Aren't you following, you know, the latest research on legumes? Lisa, thank goodness Lisa Marone's here. You don't seem to know your legumes very well, Austin. And he was saying
oh,
it
no.
in a very... He was being kind of fun, tongue-in-cheek about it, but he was very serious. And all that to say that we appreciate the wisdom we get from you, Lisa Marone, and it's getting through to people. So thank you very much.
That's my goal. Let's get healthy for heaven's sake together.
I like it. Thanks for helping us with that. Good to talk to you, Lisa. We'll look forward to talking to you again soon.
Great to speak with you. Have a super day.
Thanks, you too. It's now 25 past the hour from the Faith Radio Network. I am Austin Hill. We're glad you're with us. Breakpoint is on the way in moments. Don't go anywhere.
We want to know what you think. Join the conversation at 877-933-2484. It's Austin Hill in the morning.
I most certainly want to know what you think. It's now 35 past the hour. That is our number. It's 877-933-2484. 877-933-2484. Is it time for those of us who are adults, parents, grandparents, church leaders, youth leaders of a variety of sorts, should we tell our teenagers to no longer try to have a presence on their otherwise secular public school campus? Is it time to just back out and say, listen, this is not the place for an on-campus club, whether it's a pro-life club or maybe meeting for a Bible study group or something of that sort? Is it time to back out and just kind of abandon those kinds of activities, do you suppose? It's 877-933-2484, 877-933-2484. Here's why I ask. We have this very interesting dilemma, I'll call it, in Fargo, North Dakota. And if you're listening to us on our Fargo affiliate, you're probably fairly well acquainted with this, but a couple of high schools in the Fargo Public School District number 1, a couple of high schools have faced a bit of a uprising, if you will, wherein high school students have sought to form and conduct on-campus pro-life clubs. And the Fargo Public School District, they weighed in and denied access to these students who wanted to organize an official on-campus club. And they gave some very interesting reasons for this. For one, and this may or may not have merit to it, I don't know. I haven't seen the documentation. I haven't studied it incredibly carefully. I've read multiple news accounts of it. But I don't know that any of us, except for the immediate people involved here, really know all the details. But the school district, on some level, has said that, you know, the students who filed the paperwork, filled out the forms and submitted them to school authorities and such to have an on-campus club, well, they didn't fill out the paperwork correctly. And, of course, as is the case customarily in public schools where students form an on-campus club, the students have to have a specific staffer, preferably a teacher, but somebody else on staff at the school to be an overseer of the club, to be a sponsor of the club, right? Well, in one of the high schools, I believe it was at Davies High School in Fargo, North Dakota, school administrator said, listen, the adult who was chosen to be the sponsor of the on-campus club, while we're glad that there is an adult who's willing to step up and do this, this person isn't officially qualified to be a sponsor of a student club. So this particular adult that was chosen to oversee the club, we appreciate the staffer's willingness to volunteer and serve as the club sponsor. This just isn't going to work. In another case, however, and this was not at Davies High School, I don't believe, but this was at the other high school in question there in the Fargo area, the other school said, well, we have concerns that the pro-life club may have some specific ties to a specific church, and this may sort of intrude on the separation of church and state, the notion that we safeguard and respect here in our country. So in both cases, on two different high school campuses in the Fargo Public School District, high school student-led on-campus pro-life clubs were denied access and denied the right to organize and be a club, and in a recognized club on the campus of their high schools. Is it time for kids to just give up on this stuff? Would we be more responsible adults, parents, grandparents, student leaders, youth pastors, whatever role you might be, whatever role you may have as an adult in the life of a child, would we be more responsible if we taught our children, hey, don't try to do this because it's just, you know, it's going to offend people, and your views about the sanctity of life and being pro-life, they're just not going to fit into the public school district environment, so don't go there. I pose the question this way, not just to be provocative, although I hope it is, at the very least, provoking you to think through the issues here a little bit more clearly and a little bit more carefully. But there are those, I believe, in our churches, and I can think of people in my own church where my wife and son and I attend, I can think of people in my own church who would say, yeah, wait, who's the adult that taught these high school kids that they should force their Christian views on the sanctity of life on the school? Get out of there. That's not the place for it. Go have your club at the church or maybe in somebody's private home, but don't try to do this out in the public square. What do you think about that? That's what I'm asking you to weigh in on here. And by the way, this contention between student clubs and public institutions, public educational institutions, this is not unique to the public school district there, the K-12 public school district in Fargo, North Dakota. This is happening all over the country, not only in K-12 public school districts, but in publicly funded, taxpayer-funded colleges and universities around the country. Is it time for Christian students to just, I guess in a sense we could say, stand down, back off, don't try to bring your views and your needs and interests and concerns into the publicly funded, taxpayer-funded college or university? I've got a lot of thoughts on that, but I want to get yours. 877-933-2484. 877-933-2484. Joel is up next in Plymouth, Minnesota. Joel, thanks for holding. You're on with Austin Hill. Welcome to the program.
Hey, sir. Good morning. I think that there should be nothing wrong with these students doing this club. It's no different than like a chess club or a debate club or anything like that. What you're doing is you're just opening up the door to let other people know that, hey, there's other people like you here on campus. You know, and it's no different than the other clubs. I don't see why they shouldn't allow it.
On some level, there's no difference. In other respects, though, there's a lot of difference. I mean, I think we'd have to, you and I probably both agree on this, Joel, we'd have to admit that a club devoted to studying and advocating for the nature and essence of human life, that's a little bit more important and carries a little more weight to it than a club that is focused on studying and perfecting the game of chess, wouldn't you say?
Well, I agree with you there, but in the school's eyes, where they don't feel that the human life is that important or that abortion is wrong necessarily, it should be considered no different than that to them. To you and I, who know that, you know, God knew you before you were in your mother's womb, that, yeah, we know that it's more important than that, but the school should not be standing in the way of that any more than they do stand in the way of a chess club or a debate club.
Okay, fair enough. Joel, thanks much for the call. 877-933-2484. Leslie is up next in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Leslie, thanks for holding. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. What is wrong with teaching students their constitutional rights? I believe the Constitution allows these students to have a freedom of assembly. They also, according to the First Amendment, have freedom of speech, and they also have freedom of religion. I think this is a beautiful opportunity to teach students about the Constitution and that they do have constitutional rights, and that just because it's a pro-life club doesn't mean that it should be accepted. What other clubs should they accept and make exceptions for or push out of the sphere? You see, if you start that, if you can't let a pro-life club meet, what other clubs shouldn't meet?
Mm-hmm.
And then pretty soon you have, then you're segregating by groups of people or classes of people. According to the First Amendment, you can't do that. And
right.
So I think this is a great opportunity to teach students and, if necessary, get legal help to instate the clubs there.
Well, it's very interesting that you bring up the legal help elements, Leslie, and I appreciate the call. Thanks very much. Thank you for listening to us there in Sioux Falls. Apparently, there is legal help that has already swooped in on behalf of these high schooler students in Fargo. The Thomas More Society, a nonprofit legal foundation group, the Thomas More Society, they have sought to represent at least one of these high school campus groups of students and contacted the Fargo Public School District number 1 on behalf of the students. So there is legal assistance in the process here and involved here. But there are still, I agree with what Leslie is saying here, but there's still those well-intended, I'm sure, who would say, but, you know, forcing this pro-life thing on, you know, the public school, it's just creating consternation. If we really were being loving, we would just, you know, back off and not force our way on people like this. How about you? What do you think about this? Is it time to teach our children to just stay out of the public square and not try to participate with your Christian activities, your pro-life club, or whatever it is on a public school campus? 877-933-2484. Bob is up next in Minneapolis, listening to us on Faith 90.7 FM. Bob, welcome to the program. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. How are you?
I'm well, sir.
Good. Thank you for having us on. That's a great question. The thought I had on this is that what better training ground do we have for teaching our children to be salt and light? First of all, we want to be consistent. We don't want to be teaching to be schizophrenic and have one opinion in public and one opinion in private. Paul, for example, went to Athens and he spoke and he used the situations that were there, the many idols that they had, and said, "I see that you're religious, etc." And so I think it's really important that we teach our kids how to be salt and light, We teach our kids to stand for something. If they don't stand for something, they'll fall for anything. Mm-hmm. And then also, if we don't stand up for these moral issues, which we're supposed to do, we would all be speaking German. 60 years ago, when Nazism and fascism was coming to power, if people here in America said, you know, we just need to be loving, we just need to love them. Hitler's not that bad guy. We just need to love him. Mm-hmm. You know, we shouldn't speak out again. We shouldn't get involved with this. I mean, we would be speaking German today as opposed to having groups teaching our children how to form, how to debate, how to stand up, how to be have moral character, how to infuse their spiritual beliefs, their moral held beliefs. And what better place than in the school rooms and the classrooms that these students want to have together? I mean, this is the foundation of democracy that they are exercising, and I just think that we ought to applaud them as opposed to even put the thought that mm-hmm. they should stand down.
Bob, I appreciate your thoughtful comments very much. I hope you'll call in again and weigh in on again on another episode. Thanks for being here this morning. Notice how many times he used the word moral, as in moral issues. How can we ignore the moral issues surrounding us? I appreciate what Bob had to say. We'll continue with more of your calls in just a moment. 877-933-2484. It's the Austin Hill in the Morning program, 58 past the hour. Don't go away.
Now, back to Austin Hill in the Morning. Join the conversation by calling 877-933-2484.
49 minutes past the hour from the Faith Radio Network. I am Austin Hill. A rather interesting, teachable moment, I would like to think of it as, in Fargo, North Dakota, in one of the larger public school districts in that state, Fargo Public School District Number 1. There's high school students on a couple of different public high school campuses. And they have sought to create and form pro-life clubs on campus. They're finding it very difficult to do. Now, in one case, the high school campus said, well, you didn't fill out the paperwork and go through the proper channels, and procedurally, you didn't follow the rules and the instructions here that students need to follow in order to set up an on-campus club. Okay, the rules need to be followed. If indeed that is the case, if they don't have the proper paperwork or documentation or sponsorship or what have you, well, that needs to be fixed. But there are those, and I won't elaborate any further, but there are those in the Christian community who would say, you know, let's just teach the kids. This is political. Don't get your hands dirty with this. Don't force yourself into the school with your agenda here. That's not how you reflect the love of Christ. I will tell you that one of the things that really kind of gets under my skin with these sorts of scenarios is that when we just stand down in these kinds of environments and say, oh gosh, you know, I'm not worthy. I want to be a humble servant of Jesus Christ. I think sometimes we confuse and maybe mix up a godly sense of humility with a not so virtuous sense of not wanting to put ourselves at risk. It's risky for these kids to do this. And it's courageous when they do it. And that should be encouraged. I just don't see that the call of the gospel is a call that tries to make us less noble or less courageous. I think it takes a lot of courage to lead with one's convictions here. These kids, I think, need to be encouraged and applauded for what they're doing. But back to the phones. Linda is in Minto, North Dakota. Linda, thanks for holding. You're on with Austin Hill. Welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you very much, Austin, for covering this issue today. I think it's pertinent information for all of us to know more about what's going on. I have met Bridget, one of the young ladies that is trying to begin this club, and in fact, she told me that the paperwork was done correctly, and that was just one of their last excuses for not allowing the club to begin. She began wanting the club in September, and here we are in April.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I just really appreciate and commend these young women for wanting to do, and their friends for wanting to do a pro-life club, and think that we all as adults need to pray for them, pray for their spiritual lives. I know that they're also being taunted by some of their peers in school to keep their church out of their schools, to ask God to just continue to give them a clear sense of which way they are to go and how they are to speak for life. Already they've done that on their campuses and in our state and, in fact, in our region by doing what they've asked just to have a club.
Sure. I think you're absolutely right about that.
Whatever we can do to encourage them, we need to do that. And, in fact, Austin, you have something on your webpage as far as how to contact the Fargo School District or any information there?
Tell you what, I'm going to put you on hold, Linda, and I'll get your contact info. Let you and I talk about that and figure out how we can get the good word out and what exactly that word needs to be. So stand by, Linda. We'll get your number,
okay. And
I'll call you later.
Good.
Thanks very much. Good to hear from you. Appreciate it. Mark is up next in Marion, Iowa. Mark, welcome. You're on with Austin Hill. It's the Faith Radio Network.
Well, my thunder's kind of been taken from me from a couple of the callers and you starting out, but I think we need to commend these kids. For the last 20 to 30 years, all we've been told from the outsiders, and I'm saying non-Christian folk and some Christian folk, that, well, we just need to love them and not do this and not do that. Well, aren't we supposed to love them and teach them what they're doing wrong and help them be more godly? All we've done is been quiet. And, you know, first it was, well, we can't say the Pledge of Allegiance because it says God in it. And then it's, well, we can't say Christmas anymore because, well, that's offensive to others. Well, it shouldn't be offensive to others. Everything is offensive to everybody if you want to, you know, look at it at a global scale. No one's ever going to be happy, but this is a Christian country. Whether people want to accept it or not, especially our president, this is a Christian country. It was founded that way. We need to live that way, and we need to, you know, use these children as inspiration towards us adults to finally say, you know what, we've given and given and given, and now Christians are being pushed around and put in box and made to look like the evil ones when all we're trying to do is live by the greatest instructional booklet ever written. And it seems they're just finding every way they can to take it away from them.
Mark, and I appreciate the call very much. I would like to think that those of us grown-ups in the crowd, those of us who are adults, I'd like to think that we could look at these high school students and be inspired. Sometimes the children among us are the most inspiring among us. That doesn't mean that we can abdicate our responsibility to be the grown-ups. But I'm impressed with these young people. I'll just leave it at that for the moment. Susie is up next in Mazeppa, Minnesota. Susie, welcome. It's the Faith Radio Network. Good morning.
Good morning, Austin. I have a couple of thoughts. One, I commend the kids, and I agree with everything everybody has said so far, but there is one other issue that hasn't been brought up, and that is the Right to Life movement has a long history of violence. So I think the moderator has to be chosen well, and their bylaws have to be chosen and written well before something like that because of that long history.
Now, what is that long history? Hold on a second. What is this long history of which you speak?
They protest in front of abortion clinics and hurt people. They have been known to kill people. There was a radical part of it.
And there has been many, many years ago in the past.
Exactly, and it's still part of that culture. There's still a
where,
radical
where does that culture
it.
Exist today? The radical, deadly pro-life culture.
I just know that in debates it can be very argumentative and very hostile.
Wait a minute. Hold on a second here. Being argumentative is one thing. Deadly is something different. When have you seen a deadly incident involving the pro-life movement?
None in a number of years. But I'm just saying because of the history of it, that's what people's mindset are coming from.
Are you fearful of pro-life teenagers that somebody might get killed?
No.
Okay. I appreciate the call, Susie. Thanks very much. Good to have you with us. Just needed to clarify. Kudos to the young people. I hope we'll be in prayer for them, and we will talk more about them forthcoming.
I'm Austin Hill. Thanks for listening. Back tomorrow morning, 6 a.m. Central Time. It's the Faith Radio Network that you're listening to. Reach us at myfaithradio.com and have a great day. Thanks for listening to this podcast from Austin Hill in the Morning. For more information about this, you can visit Austin Hill in the Morning, our program page, on myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com.